I'm Dorothy Wickenden, and on today's Politics and More podcast, David Remnick, the New Yorker's editor, talks with Rukmini Callimachi about her experiences covering ISIS and about the future of Islamic extremism.
Rukmini Callimachi, who was born in totalitarian Romania and is a reporter for the New York Times, is doing some of the bravest and most astonishing reporting we have on ISIS and other terror groups.
I learned in Mali, in West Africa, where I was based for almost 8 years, that when an al-Qaeda-linked group or a jihadist group takes over an area, your initial reaction is, well, I can't go there, you know? And so you kind of put down your hands and go, I can't cover this. And in fact, I learned from covering Mali that you can go to the line of control, to the last safe place before their territory starts. And in that area, there's often refugees that are coming across. There's traders that are going back and forth. And there's survivors of whatever atrocities they're carrying out that are making it into the safe area.
The catalog of horrors Rukmini has written about is long, and the personal risk she takes is terrifying. But a lot of what she brings to the world comes from social media, where she's getting much closer to jihadists than any of us want to be. By paying attention to Twitter and other platforms, she's trying to understand what motivates these people, what makes violent extremism so alluring to these young people.
In the case of ISIS and also al-Qaeda, you have the entire body of what they say. And most of ISIS propaganda and al-Qaeda propaganda, it's coming out almost like a word vomit, you know, multiple statements a day. And I think most reporters
On Twitter, on Facebook,
on Telegram, on, you know, they make these little e-books, videos, YouTube. I mean, they're extremely prolific.
And how is this different from al-Qaeda? Al-Qaeda was, to the at least to the popular imagination, largely a secretive organization. It did not hide in plain sight, where I get the impression that ISIS wants you to know everything and more.
So al-Qaeda was secretive. ISIS has taken almost the opposite approach, where they've flooded the system. They have tens of thousands of followers on Twitter, and they are so good now at the pitch. And believe me, they've tried to convert me. And I put up with it because I want to talk to them.
How have they tried to convert you?
When I reach out to these jihadists and speak to them, and I speak to them through a variety of platforms, encrypted, non-encrypted, etc., often the way that I'll get them to talk to me is they think that they can possibly convince me to give up my faith and accept theirs. The fact that I'm Christian, to them, they think gives them an avenue. Because I therefore, you know, already have a faith. And they will then try to convince me that Christ was actually just a prophet. And so I put up with this. You know, it's sometimes very tiring. There was one guy called Abu Khalid al-Amriki, who I think was, according to reports, was killed in a drone strike a couple months ago. And it was just incessant.
I mean, you met him where?
I never met him. I spoke to him on a platform called Kik. He's an African-American from the U.S., not clear where. He claimed he was a Christian before. And he came out in one of these early videos, you know, threatening the West. But it was just relentless. And, you know, to humor him, he would send me videos and say, Rukmini, I will not talk to you until you watch this video. So I'd go and watch the video, you know, and then come back to him with more questions. But did you see the video? Did you see what it said about Christ?
Were we slow to recognize the rise of ISIS? Was it rising in plain sight?
I think on the one hand, we have done ourselves a disservice, and I mean journalists and policy analysts, by constantly underestimating ISIS. And we've been doing that since 2012, 2013. The JV comments, you know, were sort of the framework for it. But we continue to not take them seriously, you know? And I know, because I speak to them, I know that they're dead serious. I know that they really, these are people that are willing to pay with their lives, not in some metaphorical sense. They are willing to die for this now.
We're sitting here in our nice, warm, and or air-conditioned homes in the West.
Yes.
And we watch what we're able to watch and read what we're able to read. And we're not just reading about resentful cadres fighting the Western invader. We're, alas, used to this by now. We're seeing something else. We're seeing a level of depredation, of beheadings,
right,
of as you've reported really brilliantly in the Times, of sexual crime committed against Yazidi women, against children, rape as a means of control, of self-satisfaction. The list goes on. It's so extensive and so grotesque that it even offends Al-Qaeda. It even offends groups that you would have thought unoffendable.
Right.
When you think about this, why is this happening? What is driving people to what to us can only seem acts of that goes well beyond the political, that it goes into an area of psychosis?
Right. What drives it?
Yeah.
My God, I mean, that's like the billion-dollar question. I can say from the people I've interviewed who either became jihadists or attempted to become and then pulled themselves back, once you buy into their brand of Islam and you sort of let down your guard, there's something exciting to them about being part of this apocalyptic project. You know, they literally believe that they are living at the moment before the rapture, to use a Christian corollary. They think they're at, you know, on the verge of this end of times battle. And it's not just some sort of metaphor. They really believe that this is going to happen and that they are there. You know, a lot of them have profile pictures of them on horses. They think they're going to be there on their black steed at the moment of the end of the world. And there's something, you know, a lot of ISIS members are basically teenagers, you know, and sort of early 20s. And think back to how impressionable one is.
This is the hard thing. We fundamentalism exists in various forms and sadly in all religions.
Right.
But this is different, is it not?
It's a form of fundamentalism, right?
I mean the level...
The level of intensity of it.
The level of organization, the level of cruelty, the level of millenarian thinking.
Yeah. And the thing with the cruelty is that I really do think that the senses get dull to it. And I just came back from Iraq, as you know. One of the interviews that I did was with a young boy. I think he was 12. And he's a Yazidi child who had been separated from his mother and sent forcibly to a recruitment camp. And part of his training, he was taken by a Saudi deputy emir. Part of his training was the sheikh would take him into his office, sit him down at his plush chair in front of the laptop, and force him to watch beheading video after beheading video after beheading video. They actually had a photo of it that they had posted on Facebook that he showed me. And you see this little kid with this blanched face just looking at this, you know. And once you see this over and over and over again, I can say even for myself, because I've been forced to watch these videos.
It becomes normalized in some terrible way.
It becomes normalized. And a couple of months ago, you know, the ISIS, I don't think, could have predicted the PR hit that they got from the James Foley execution. I'm sure they thought it was going to be important.
And when you say PR hit, you mean it in a perversely positive sense.
Yes. I mean, recruitment spiked. Twitter traffic to the Islamic State spiked. The woman that I ended up profiling from Washington State, a Sunday school teacher, that was the avenue that brought her to them. You know, she saw this and went, "Oh my God!" And then she reached out to them, and within weeks, she was thinking that they're her friends. You know,
but pause on that. Pause on that.
Yeah,
you're a teacher in the state of Washington.
Yes,
and you see a human being beheaded.
Yes,
and this is attractive to you. And it causes you to completely transform your wife.
It's not attractive. She was disgusted and horrified by it, but she had never seen anything like that before. And this is a young woman who, like a lot of young people, had really no connection to the news. And she heard on CNN that they were on Twitter and that they were under the hashtag Message to America. So she went on Twitter, like all young people do, and found the hashtag and decided to send questions to them. And what surprised her is that they responded. She couldn't believe, you know, that these so-called terrorists were taking the time to write to her. And then the thing that really surprised her is that they were nice to her. And this is a young woman who has a bit of a misfit, you know, existence. She has some disabilities. doesn't have a lot of friends, doesn't have a lot of things to do. And suddenly she has this community.
She's embraced.
She's embraced. She's loved. She's sent. And you see these messages just gushing with affection. My dear sister, how are you today? How's your blood pressure? Are you feeling better? Do you have a cold? Take this medicine for this cold. How's your gardening going? Oh, those kind of greens are better planted here. She suddenly has something to do. And so what the cognitive dissonance for her was, these people are called terrorists, but they're some of the nicest people I've ever spoken to. Mm-hmm. So therefore, what the media is saying about them must be wrong.
And your sources, when you talk to them, do they exaggerate? Is there any way to verify what their when they're talking about ideology or their ideas or their enthusiasms, but their experiences?
Of course they exaggerate. You know, of course it's always like this. Abu Khalid al-Amraki tried to claim to me that he was holding multiple American hostages. And because this happens to be something that I followed very closely, I know he wasn't holding, you know, American hostages. And I called his bluff on it, and he got kind of upset and didn't talk to me for a couple of days.
And in this world, in this world, Rukmini, what factor does it play that you're a woman in this world working as a reporter? Mm. How do you navigate that, good, bad, or indifferent, literally down to the details of what you wear, how you have to behave. Does it matter that you, is it almost an advantage that you're working with a translator sometimes?
Mm. On the one hand, the initial access to the jihadists is, I think, harder for me than if I were a man. I've had many of them shut me down, you know, citing Quranic verses that prohibit them from speaking to women that are not family. But once I'm in, I feel that I have an advantage because they see me as soft, they see me as female, they see me as these things. And so there's kind of like a sweet spot, you know, for a while. And then very quickly from there, it goes to them hitting on me. And that's when it all goes to hell, because as soon as, you know, I have to say very clearly, early on now I say, and by the way, I'm married. Here's a little bit about me. I live in the New York area. And I always throw in very early on that I'm married and happily so, to try to shut down, you know, that avenue. There was this one guy, he was a member of Al-Qaeda. And I worked on this guy for almost a year, David. I had a post-it note next to my bed because he was, I suspected he was in Egypt. I wasn't totally sure, but by the time difference, I think he was in Egypt. And so he was getting up for early morning prayers around the time when I was going to bed. And so at every night, I tried to like start texting him, you know, a little bit and have a little bit of discussion. And he always had like, it was like this thing he was dangling in front of me where I always felt like he was almost going to start talking to me, almost, you know, open up. And a year into it, by the way, in the process of this year, he pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. He left Al-Qaeda. So I was able to sort of, I was able to get something, you know, out of this. And a year in, he finally said, Rukmini, I have something to tell you. And I'm like, yes, what, you know, what are you going to tell me? And please, you know, this is something quite sensitive. And I said, oh, sure, great, you know, go ahead. And he said, you remind me of a woman I wanted to marry. And I was like, oh, my God. You know, like, oh, my God, you know, like, you know, all of that effort for that.
Boy, I've been reporting a very long time. That's never happened to me.
Right.
Oh, God.
Right. And
getting hit on by Al-Qaeda.
Right. Right.
So how did this get resolved?
I'm married. I'm happily married. He actually sent me a message. The last time we spoke was 3 or 4 months ago, and he sent me a message saying that he's just gotten married. It's like, good.
Some major figures in American politics and also in the foreign policy world, ranging from the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, to Leon Panetta, who headed the CIA and the Pentagon, have used the same metaphor to describe what's going on in the Middle East in particular, which is that it's going to be a 30-year war. Mm-hmm. Why is this going to be with us for so long? What is the complication? Mm. How do you see it ending?
Oh, my God. Honestly, I don't see it ending. I mean, I wonder if in our lifetime we're going to see the end of this, because what I see.
Maybe we should define what this is. That means what?
The problem of extreme Islam. But on the other hand, militarily, what I saw in northern Iraq and in Syria is that when you put real force against them, it's like pushing on an open door. And this is what happens with these groups, is I think if you have a real force pushing them back, they fold very quickly. The problem is you then have to stay. And does the United States or any Western power, do they want to stay, you know, in these places? And now the question isn't just staying in Iraq. then now the question is staying in Iraq, Syria, Libya, Nigeria, pretty soon Somalia, the Sinai. They're trying to take over Bangladesh, Afghanistan. I mean, you know, and not to mention the suburbs of Paris. Mm-hmm. That's
why your forecast is for a very, very long
war. I think so, because I think it's what I've seen about this ideology is it's almost like a poison that enters the groundwater. And how do you get it out?
Rukmini, yeah. Thank you so much, and I'd love to have you back again.
Thanks, David. It's a pleasure.
That was David Remnick talking with reporter Rukmini Kalamaki.